broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
And the field for cotton goods that is every day enlarging as the East is answering to the impatient calls of commerce gives no prospect of a speedy check to this vast power of the produce of the slave. Luck is a field white as stars in a sky of jade. Harvest season, heads full of cotton, hands full of cotton. We dream of buds aching green with envy, flaring their white blossoms open at dawn, pink by sundown, then red, withering until the bowls beneath crack open, foaming white, this high cotton we're rolling in, our mouths so full we choke on our own spit.
Cotton mouth. By Holly Karapetkova, read by the author. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're on the road today, coming to you from the Writers Center in Chevy Chase, Maryland. In August 1619, a pirate ship dropped anchor off Jamestown, Virginia. 20 to 30 slaves were offloaded, who were then sold to the colonists. This was only 12 years after the founding of the colony. It was 1 year before the Puritans landed at Plymouth Rock, and 157 years before the Declaration of Independence. 400 years ago, last month, at Colonial Jamestown, slavery was woven into the very fabric of our country. Is it any wonder, then, that racism is endemic to our society? Poet Holly Karapetkova is my guest today. Her writings are broad-reaching and particularly unveil the deep wounds left by our history of racism, slavery, and environmental destruction. Holly's poetry, prose, and translations have appeared widely in print and online in places such as Alaska Quarterly Review, The Southern Review, Prairie Schooner, Poetry Northwest, The Delmarva Review, and the Nashville Review. Her books include Words We Might One Day Say, winner of the 2010 Washington Writers Publishing House Poetry Award, and Towline, winner of the 2016 Vern Rutsala Poetry Contest from Cloudbank Books. In addition to her poetry and translations, Holly has written more than 20 books for children. She teaches in the Department of Literature and Languages at Marymount University. Holly, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writers Edition.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
If it's okay with you, I'd like to begin our discussion with your series of poems on slavery, published in volume 11 of the Delmarva Review. We began the broadcast with Cotton Mouth, which you read beautifully, quite frankly. Please tell us a bit about this poem, and then something of the series itself. For instance, why do you write so much on the issue of slavery?
Yes, that's a question I'd like to answer very much. The poem Cottonmouth is part of a large number of poems that I have written delving into primary sources addressing the issue of slavery. And my interest in this topic began with more contemporary exploration of race and racism and whiteness. I tend to think I don't actively choose subjects for my poetry, that they find their way to me. And I just felt a need several years ago, it's about 6 or 8 years ago now, to begin writing about my experiences with whiteness, some of the issues that I had with whiteness, which I feel is a kind of psychosis, it's a kind of national sickness that we're dealing with. And I wanted to explore some of the ramifications of whiteness and some of the absurdity and horrors of it.
On a personal level, yeah. Holly, where did that need, where do you think that need to write on slavery came from?
Yeah, well, I was born and raised in the South, in Atlanta, Georgia, in the late 70s and through the decade of the 80s. So it was an environment in which I was very much aware of race and white privilege. I was raised in a neighborhood that was predominantly white and very middle class and quite racist, to be perfectly frank. However, I was in this city that was really making great strides in terms of racial equality. There was tremendous political power that African Americans were gaining, a lot of wealth, a lot of wealthy African Americans were moving to Atlanta. And the culture, the black culture in Atlanta is just tremendous. The music scene and then the other arts that have kind of flocked to the city. So I was surrounded by, my immediate environment was quite racist, to be frank, but I was surrounded by this larger environment, and I went to school with a lot of African American kids, and the larger environment was telling me that there was a problem with that story of white supremacy. And so I think I've been grappling with this issue for years, and of course, you know, as I've come into adulthood, I've raised more intellectual questions with white supremacy. I've done a lot of reading and a lot of research into the topic. And for a long time, I was silent in terms of my poetry about the issue because, I didn't want to say something hurtful. As a white person, a lot of times we do when we talk about the subject of race. We tend to put our foot in it in very unhelpful ways sometimes. So I was afraid of doing something hurtful. I was also afraid of, I didn't want to take the spotlight away from black writers and writers of color who are writing about the issue, who have a lot to say about it, and it feels like they should be the voices heard on the issue.
You feel like you were intruding?
Well, possibly. But then as I began to think about it more and more, the silence from white writers on the topic of race and the fact that many white writers don't even mention this, this part of our lives that is just, I mean, it's a huge part of our lives as Americans, race and racial identity and white supremacy is everywhere. And I think we're all acutely aware of white supremacy now, but it's just resurgent, but it's been here for, you know, since the inception of this country. So the silence that I heard on the part of white writers regarding race is what really sort of kicked me into action. I thought, I can't be silent about this. It's something that affects all of us. And my silence could be just as hurtful as me, quote, getting it wrong.
Holly, you've written more than 20 children's books.
Yes, I have.
And so I get the sense maybe you started with children's books. Well, my question is, did thinking about what you want to say to these children and what you wanted to say in these books contribute in any way to your progression on to writing poetry and then writing poetry about slavery in particular?
Yeah, I actually started writing poetry first, and my mother is a big figure in childhood education, so through her I started writing books for children, and also when I had my own children, I, you know, through conversations with them and interactions with them, I sort of felt called to write children's books. It was something that I really wanted to do. And yes, absolutely, as I was thinking through some difficult issues, I wrote a series of books about national landmarks. So I wrote a book about the Capitol, the United States Capitol, which was built by slaves. And so I felt kind of torn when I was writing those books. How much can I say about this subject? I want people to know, children need to know the history of their country accurately. And yet, I had to answer to a publisher, and how much was I going to be allowed to talk about the issue of slavery? With my own children, of course, I can have those conversations, very frank conversations about race and the state of race in this country. And I can make them very aware of their white privilege. But I felt like probably in writing for children, I felt limited for a variety of reasons in terms of what I could say. So,
Cottonmouth is a very interesting poem. Tell us about Cottonmouth. What are you presenting us with that poem?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's really important to keep in mind about slavery is the economic dependence that we had in our early stages as a nation. We would not have grown the wealth and power that we have today without slave labor. Same, likewise, without the Holocaust of Native peoples and the displacement of Native peoples. So our whole society is based on this horrific acts of trauma and violence. And so it's very important to me in this poem to talk about some of the economic roots of slavery. And the truth of the matter is that the North was every bit as dependent on slavery as the South. And so it's really interesting if you do a lot of reading into the history. A lot of anti-slavery activists in the North actually had ships that traded slaves or, you know, slave goods. So they had their hands, even as they were activists against slavery, they were simultaneously making wealth from slavery. So it's a really complicated part of our society. It's really endemic and was woven into every bit of the fabric of our country.
Well, right at the very beginning, as we heard from that little piece that, mm-hmm. that I read early on. But Holly, our mouths so full, mm-hmm. we choke on our own spit.
Yeah.
Where are we with that?
So I said earlier, I feel that whiteness is a kind of psychosis, and I feel that slavery was just a horrific, horrific experience for everyone involved. Certainly, the violence that happened to black bodies is something that white people did not experience. But I often think, I delved into the primary sources in writing these poems a great deal. And I often think of what happens to a world where very young children, young white children, were taught to be brutal and violent towards other black children, even towards black adults. There's a quote that I can never get out of my head. It comes out of the American Slave Project, and I can't remember the name of the person, the individual who said this, but it's a slave remembering how her master would tell his boys to go down to the quarters and get him some more slaves. So these young boys, probably, I have a 14-year-old son, probably about my son's age, were being told to go and rape and do violence in order to increase their father's property.
You talked a few minutes ago about the business aspect of slavery and the
yes.
fact that even Northerners owned slave ships mm-hmm. that transported slaves. Read Transactions mm-hmm. for us,
yes.
if you would, and then tell us about that poem, Transactions.
Absolutely. So this poem also has an epigraph. It's from Rachel O'Connor in 1832, and you can read her letters in a book called Mistress of Evergreen Plantation. And she says, "I have 16 young calves on my book for this year, and my guinea hogs grow finely. Black Sam's eldest daughter, Jenny, had a little daughter on the 14th of April. That makes 3 mulattoes born this year and living yet. Dear, I rode about the fields today, first time since the rains. Happily, not all the bulls are ruined. This will be a good crop. We had some 70 bales ginned and pressed and sent down the river a fortnight past. I got 12 young shoats coming along, and half a dozen calves will make a fine market next spring. Also some pretty foals. And Sydney gave birth last week, which makes 3 Negroes born already this year, sucking babes another on the way. The corn is tall as my waist, so you can see how things is progressing right well. There is more than enough to be thankful for.
What's going on in this poem, Holly?
So this poem is very much in the voice of Rachel O'Connor. I spent a lot of time with her letters, and she speaks extensively in her transactions mostly with her brother, who was helping her manage her property. She was either, I can't remember how she got her property, either from her father or from her husband. Possibly she was a widow. Many women did run plantations and own slaves. There's a new book out called They Were Her Property, and I'm forgetting the author of that book, but it talks about the financial benefit that women had from slavery and the women who owned slaves and the property that they had because of that. And so she speaks extensively. She tends to be what you might call a, quote, good mistress. She cared a lot about the well-being of her slaves, and she quarreled with any overseer who was rough with her slaves, so she protected them physically. But on the other hand, they are her property. And so she grows very fond of some of them, especially the young ones, but she still continues to see them as like her livestock. They are her wealth. And she depends on them for her well-being, and she's also the manager of them.
How does one compare slave babies to Schultz?
Yeah. I mean,
what is the psychology going on there?
That's why I wrote these poems. That's why I started this project. I wanted to figure out. I started it less as judgment, although, of course, you know, there's nobody in their right mind that would say slavery is okay or judge it anything other than a great moral wrong. Except at that time, right? And so I wanted to figure out how people who otherwise saw themselves as good, ethical human beings could own slaves and be okay with that. And there's a really nice quote I brought from Bertolt Brecht. He says, remember when you speak of our failings, the dark time too, which you have escaped. So it's a warning against judging things that have happened in the past. And so I entered this project not with judgment, but with curiosity and trying to understand how did this system take place. And we have plenty of evidence of slavery in 21st century. We have, you know, human trafficking, there's sex slavery. There are many, many people who don't have control over their own bodies. And yet we are, especially here in the United States, we're largely separated from that system. We don't see it every day, and we can very easily ignore it if we want to. But here you have a case where people lived with their slaves. They were in very close contact with these other human beings, and they often profess to love their slaves. They speak of them as their children, and they love their slaves as they love their children, and they care for them, and they nurse them in sickness, and they're very proud of this, the mistresses, plantation mistresses, and yet they also consider them property. So how does a human being get to the point where they've convinced themselves that that makes sense? And they did.
In this poem, Transactions, for me, what really came to me was in a sense what you've just said, how personal this activity was, but at the same time how abstract, because it was business.
Yeah.
And the psychology of that.
Yeah.
I really have a lot of trouble grasping, and is that I assume that's one of the things you were working on as you wrote and structured these poems.
Yes. These primary sources are very hard to read, and I'll be honest, the sources that I was reading were primarily written from white women's perspectives. They're not nearly as harrowing as the stories that the slaves themselves tell, and the American Slave Project is just horrendous reading. It's very, very difficult reading. and to hear the ways that these women speak about slavery and to hear the way that they speak about other human beings is really, really difficult. I was hoping, when I started this project, I was hoping to find more sympathy between mistresses and their slaves. I was hoping maybe there was, you know, moments when they connected as people, when they had empathy with these people that they owned. I didn't really find much of that, sadly. I did find women who questioned the value of slavery and the ethical aspects of owning slaves. So I did find women who were suspicious that slavery was not a good thing. However, they would then turn around and say black people are lazy, and this is even after the Civil War, and they often had black domestic workers, and they would complain about their laziness. So even the more educated women who were more reflective and saw the wrongs of slavery could then turn around and either talk about their property or talk about their domestic workers in horribly, horribly racist terms that really misunderstand the humanity of the situation and what these black women were going through. So, I mean, there are the Grimke sisters. There's Fanny Kemble, who was a British actress who married a plantation owner. And she was horrified by what she saw on the plantation, but she's an outsider. There are also stories of northern women marrying into the southern plantation system and being appalled. But most of the women who were born and raised within that system found it fairly tolerable and acceptable, and certainly it took a lot of burden off of them.
Well, I'm really interested in this dichotomy that I think keeps showing up in these slave poems particularly. And that is, again, the sense that the activity and the sense is so personal, as we find in transactions, is so personal, and yet at the same time is so abstract. So how is the slave in this sense viewed? Is it like the horse?
Yeah.
In the barn that you love, or the dog at your feet.
Mm-hmm.
It's an object. It's an animal that is different. That is separate.
Yeah. It depends. It varies. These white women are all different individuals, so they have varying points of view. But I have an interesting quote. After Uncle Tom's Cabin came out, there were a large number of pro-slavery novels written in response to Uncle Tom's Cabin by white women. And I have a very interesting quote here that kind of corresponds with some of the religious themes that we might talk about as well. And it's from a book called Louise Elton by Mary Herndon. And one of the characters said, "I believe that the white race are special favorites with our Heavenly Father, that he made the Negro for their benefit, just as much as I believe that he made for our use the horse, the cow, or the sheep. Only he favored us more in the mental structure of the Negro, for he gave them power to think, to understand what we desire them to do, and to converse with us in an intelligible manner." And then later, the same character goes on to say, "Freedom amongst Negroes is just as useless as razors among children."
Well, you get into a little bit of that with your poem, Cursed.
Yes.
Would you read Cursed for us?
Absolutely. And this one also, all these poems have epigraphs. I felt it was important.
Well, before you get in the poem, as a writer, and mm-hmm. for our writers who are listening, explain the relationship. Why did you choose epigraphs? And explain the relationship between the epigraphs and your poems.
Yes, absolutely. I don't often use them when I'm writing other sorts of poetry, but because these poems are so historically situated and because they speak to such a very particular circumstance, a time and place, and because they're also really interacting extensively with these other voices, these primary sources that I read, I felt it was really important to give them some context. And so these epigraphs are meant to give context.
What one thing I found with the epigraphs mm-hmm. is that they made the poetry much more biting.
Oh,
and
good.
Much more personal.
Oh, good.
And I think they are crucial, in a sense, to the poem, because again, for me, of that relationship, mm-hmm. that you have this epigraph, and then you just kind of drop deeply into the epigraph with the poem. I mean, you hit a new level with the poem, which I found fascinating.
Thank you for saying that. I'm glad to know that worked.
It worked. It worked. Read Cursed for
us. Yes, and so this one has an epigraph as well, and this is from another one of those pro-slavery novels. This one was called Aunt Phyllis's Cabin, or Southern Life as It Is, from 1852 by Mary Eastman. Is it not preposterous that any man, any Christian, should read these verses and say slavery was not instituted by God as a curse on Ham and Canaan and their posterity? The lines of man divide in the desert. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the curse of Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be. The curse of our mother Eve, who knelt beneath the tree, let the serpent twine his tail between her legs. In sorrow shalt thou bring forth children. If we have sinned in submitting ourselves to one, in ruling over another, let judgment come from God, who alone can dispute the point. A rib sectioned from a chest, a father rolling in his own drunkenness, a line drawn in the dust.
What are you talking about in this poem?
So,
Holly.
Yeah, I it's really interesting, again, the kind of mental somersaults that people did under slavery to try to convince themselves that it was okay. And one of the things that they used were passages from the Bible. And the Bible talks extensively about slavery, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And even in the New Testament, there are passages, it's mostly from the epistles, it's not from Jesus himself, but there are passages that say slaves should obey their masters. And they compare the relation of a slave and a master to the relation of God and human beings. And so there's some really disturbing quotes from the Bible about slavery. Now, we usually think of the Bible as a contextual document. There are a lot of things in it that are wonderful, that are spiritually enlightening. And there are also things in it that are relative to the time and place in which the Bible was written. And in that time, slavery was a fact of life. It was endemic. It was everywhere. It was not the same form of slavery that was present in America, because it was not a slavery based on race. But it was nevertheless, it was a fact of life. And so there is some mention in the Bible that after Noah's sons saw him drunk, two of them made fun of his drunkenness, and the third covered him and looked away. And those two sons who were looking at him are cursed. And so that becomes the curse of Canaan, and the curse says they will be servant of servants. And so that was often used to justify, people said, well, those cursed sons are black, and they bear the mark of Cain, which is blackness.
Well, Ham was supposedly the father of the African
right.
Humanity. So
right.
So Ham has always been assumed
yes.
to be black.
Yes. But it was another means of justifying
absolutely.
Slavery. Yeah, I mean yeah. there's no we know there's no scientific evidence at all whatsoever that this is the case. You know, the Bible is a series of myths in a way. I mean, some of it has historical relevance, but you know, did Noah actually exist?
Well, this was
right.
this was really interesting in terms of how the Bible was viewed
mm-hmm.
At that time, because one still in some quarters take that all literally.
Yes.
And
yes.
So this is
yeah,
what it said. So
yeah.
It's very convenient for us
convenient.
To use mm-hmm. this as a rationale mm-hmm. for this literally business endeavor that
yeah.
we're in with all this free labor.
Absolutely.
Oh, we've got.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is not the only case when the Bible has been used to justify immoral behavior, right? But it is a very, very telling one. And yes, it absolutely was used to justify this kind of wealth and this kind of prosperity that people had.
It's interesting.
It is.
Noah is an interesting character in the Bible. The whole scene of the sons seeing him asleep,
right,
and naked, and we forget that it was also Noah who seduced his two daughters.
Yeah.
As well. So it's not.
Yeah.
Not particularly a pretty picture.
And that's here. The thing about the Bible. There's a lot of things in it that are not pretty, and that we do not regard today as important. And you know, that there's all kinds of dictates about how women should wear their hair and how food should be prepared, and there are pretty horrific scenes of battle where the men are told to slaughter. God tells the men to slaughter all of the men and all of the women except for the young girls who haven't known a man, and those girls they should take for themselves. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of really unpleasant parts of the Bible that we conveniently ignore, and we pull out bits that, you know, bits that serve our purposes.
Yeah, we're very selective.
And yeah. And it's unfortunate because, again, like I said, there's a lot of wisdom and truth in the Bible. And it's unfortunate that it has been used in these kinds of ways.
Well, I think in this poem, Cursed, you use the biblical imagery incredibly well. Let's read one more. From the slave of your poems about slavery, and then we're going to shift gears a little bit. Would you read Responsibility for us, because this gets us a little bit more into the head of the mistress, mm-hmm, of the household.
Yes, and this one, as all the others, has an epigraph. This time it's from Virginia Housewife or Methodical Cook from 1828 by Mary Randolph. When the kitchen breakfast is over and the cook has put all things in their proper places, the mistress should go in to give her orders. The mistress must tax her own memory with all this. We have no right to expect slaves or hired servants to be more attentive to our interest than we ourselves are. With one hand, I serve tea cakes on the blue India china. With the other, I wipe mosquitoes sweating from my neck. With one voice, I order French tureens from Calder's and Company. With another, I order the cook not to burn the gravy. The hush of what is beneath the damask tablecloth at night grows knives. With one mouth, I smile at the good doctor. With the other, I grit my teeth, watching dark eyes always watching me. They know what moves in shadows, refuse to polish the silver for love of tarnish. They know the other names for everything, names they flash like knives when no one is around looking.
I know this poem can be read different, mm-hmm, ways, and I'm going to ask you to do that in a moment. But, mm-hmm, with that kind of straightforward narrative version you've read, who is this woman, and how does she see the servants, the slaves, in her house, in your poem here?
Yeah, well, this is an imagined woman, in my mind. But based on a lot of primary source reading that I did, and there's a really interesting sense among plantation mistresses, slave-owning women, that they were the mothers, that they were caretaking for these slaves, and they prattle on and on and on in their letters and diaries about how much trouble it is to get slaves to do what they want, right? And they're basically talking about resistance on the part of the slaves, but they call it laziness, idleness, insubordination, whatever they call it. or they call them stupid, right? So there's all these stories they're telling themselves about their slaves' resistance and unhappiness that they're refusing to see. They keep telling themselves that they're meant to be slaves and they need slavery because otherwise they're just crazy monkeys over in Africa. And there is a there is a passage that talks about slaves, bringing slaves over from Africa, that I find really disturbing, and also talks about their idleness. And this is from Eliza Andrews in her wartime journal. So this was during the Civil War. She said, "It does seem to me a waste of time for people who are capable of doing something better to spend their time sweeping and dusting while scores of lazy Negroes that are fit for nothing else are lying around idle. Dr. Calhoun suggested it would be a good idea to import some of those man-apes from Africa and teach them to take the place of the Negroes, but Henry said that just as soon as we had got them tame and taught them to be of some use, those crazy fanatics of the North would insist on coming down here to emancipate them and give them universal suffrage."
I caught the name of the good doctor.
Yes.
In there that yes. You mentioned. Yeah, well... let me go back to the question. That does illustrate the mindset fairly well. This poem, though, it gets us inside her mind. Tell us about that mind and how she sees. What are these shadows, these knives under the tablecloth?
So I had to do some imagining in places because there are a lot of things that white women do not talk about. And they do not talk, they occasionally talk about their doubts about slavery. And they talk about their frustrations with their slaves. But I had to imagine, and I could do this because I too live as a white woman in a very racist society. So I remember from my very early childhood, where I grew up in a very diverse environment, but I remember this interesting kind of fear of black people, primarily because I think now when I look back on and reflect on it, because I was afraid of becoming that. And also some part of me must have known that this kind of racial hierarchy was wrong, that these were people just like me, and that there was a random ideology that decided that white was good and black was not, right? That there is some part of you, I think, that recognizes that randomness and that recognizes that with just a tiny little twist of fate, you could be on the other side. And so I think I kind of channeled that fear, and I think a lot about that fear, and I remember it, and try to figure out what it is, but I think it has to do with that fear of becoming something that you've been taught is less than, or something you've been taught, and not in my case, I wasn't taught to hate black people, but you know, it's part of white supremacy. And so I had to think there was some fear there. I had to think that they knew these people had desires and hopes and loves and fears just like they did. I had to think they feared this system to some extent. I know they were afraid of rebellion. And they were afraid of the knowledge.
Well, there were a number of significant rebellions. There were significant rebellions.
So. Yes, there were. And they do talk about those. And they were afraid of the significant knowledge that their, you know, slaves had. And there's just a lot of things that they don't talk about that I tried to imagine in some of these poems.
Well, this poem is published in two columns.
Yes.
And it can be read down. You read it across.
Yes, the first time.
The first time. Mm-hmm. Read it the other way you intended for it to be read, and tell us a little bit about the structure and why.
Mm-hmm. With one hand, the blue. With the other, sweating. With one voice, tureens from Calder's, with another, not to burn. The hush of damask at night. With one mouth, my good doctor, with my teeth always. They know what moves, refuse to polish, for love of the other names they flash when no one is around. I serve tea cakes on India China. I wipe mosquitoes from my neck. I order French and company. I order the cook, the gravy. What is beneath the tablecloth grows knives. I smile at the other. I grit, watching dark eyes, watching me. In shadows, the silver tarnish. They know for everything, names like knives, looking.
The first reading is very moving. It's somewhat straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
This reading mm-hmm. is, I don't know exactly how to say it. Somewhat scary. somewhat ominous. Ominous mm-hmm. is probably the better word. Is that your intent here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was trying to show the nice, neat surface that everyone put on things, and they would talk about their servants as opposed to slaves often, right? So there was this kind of nice surface put on the situation of slavery and on the household, and they had a sort of image to uphold. And underneath, there was this really sick and disturbing, violent system that they were a part of. And one of the things that these poems don't address, but one of the things that I do address in the series and that I had to think about a lot when I was writing these poems is the rape of slave women. And
well, you have, we're not going to read it, but you do have
a poem.
That's
true. Yeah, I do have one.
You do
one
have
in
a
here.
Poem that yeah, speaks I do have to one that.
Here. Yeah, so it was, you know, it was very common.
Magnificent poem.
Yeah,
too.
Thank you. It was very common for masters to rape their slaves. Like I mentioned that quote before, it increased their property,
increasing the stock.
Yeah, and there are a lot of ways that women, when they did talk about it, they often tried to justify it to themselves, but most of the time they just didn't talk about it. And they had to have known oftentimes that there were slave children that were their husband's children. And I can't imagine what psychologically it would have been like to live in those circumstances.
Is this political poetry?
Well, I mean, everything is political in a sense. Even poetry that's trying not to be political is making a political statement by trying not to be. But I tend to think that poetry and politics have different objectives and different languages. And I think the purpose of poetry for me is to ask questions. It's to get down into the messy ambiguity of what it is to be a human being and to be comfortable with things that are unresolved and things that don't quite make sense. And I've heard this quote many times. I don't even know who to attribute it to anymore. But in poetry, many things can be true at once. Poetry is not after a single truth. And politics wants it black and white. They want things nice and neat. And, you know, there's a reason that people are believing some of those crazy Facebook posts that Russia or whoever is putting up, those fake posts, and, you know, that Hillary is Satan. And, you know, there's ones on the other side, too, of blacktivists, right? We're going to, you know, take back our, or overcome social injustice and, you know, the black fist. And there's a reason people want things to be simple in politics, and poetry refuses to let things be simple. So I'm not trying to make a political statement. I am not trying to condone what these women did. I'm also not trying to condemn it. And I just want to understand, because I think by understanding it, maybe we can unravel some of the mess that we're in now.
But it's clear you want us to understand as well. You want to challenge us.
Yes.
To question ourselves.
Yes.
To question. I find that one of the reasons I like these poems and in fact your poetry so much is that, number one, it is political. But mm-hmm. at the same time, it is an expression of ideas. It is a creation of imagery
mm-hmm.
and also a prompter of emotion. And so reading these poems, for me, it seems we kind of run the gamut here of the ideas of the political thrust and of the image of this woman wiping the mosquitoes from her neck.
Yeah.
And we get a sense of the feeling of the emotional content. Like I said, it's somewhat has an ominous feeling when you read it.
That's good. I'm glad.
That's right. But I'd like to shift, we have a few minutes left. I'd like to shift gears a little bit now. And I'd like to ask you to read the song of the exiles, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. Song of the Exiles. There never was a garden, only a leaving. Miles and miles of footprints in the dirt. In the beginning, the shattered sun, the wind, and nothing left but our shadows sifting through the dust behind us. When we turned, we did not turn to salt. When we turned, there was nothing behind us to burn, nothing to return to. Though who could blame us for turning, with only the long days ahead, tongues tripping in the dirt? They said we didn't belong. They blamed us for leaving the garden, which never was or would be. Where could we go, we who had come from nowhere and hence could not return?
Holly, your poems, for me, seem to be driven by something. To use a big 50 Cent word, there's kind of a metaphysical underpinning to these poems. For instance, there never was a garden.
Yeah.
It's an incredible import in that little beginning, because we're saying, well, wait a minute, what do you mean? If there was never a garden, boom, all this other stuff happens. I find them built around a kind of metaphysics or a deeper sense, a sense anyway of the way the world works, of the way things are put together and we relate to it. Am I right about this at all, or am I just kind of reading in something here?
Oh, I hope so. I hope you're right. I would be thrilled and delighted if my poems are doing that kind of work. Yes, I mean, I hope that they are. This poem in particular comes out of a lot of places. It comes out of a long time. My husband is a political refugee and was in exile. He's not anymore. He's Bulgarian. But he, for many years, could not return to Bulgaria while it was communist. I've spent a lot of time between cultures myself, so I have a kind of sense that I don't really belong anywhere.
What culture?
Oh, Bulgaria in particular. I've spent a lot of time there. And when you spend a lot of time elsewhere, you start to feel like you don't really belong back home, or where is home, and you just don't really fit anywhere anymore. And you have a larger sense of peoples and movement and migration and displacement. And this poem also comes out of the story of one of my students who walked here unaccompanied from Guatemala when he was 13. So it comes out of his story as well. And who knows what horrors he saw along the way. He never talked about it. But we, you know, this kind of judgment, I feel, that comes out of our society, particularly now, towards immigrants and towards people who are trying to escape something that is an impossible living situation, right? So, you know, if you're leaving a garden that doesn't exist, where are you going to go? And I have a sense that's the situation a lot of refugees and immigrants are in right now. And I feel like, I don't feel like my poetry is political, but I feel like it's socially engaged.
I was just going to say, so on the one hand, this is a political poem about immigration.
It references those specific situations, but it doesn't make that clear in the poem. The poem is out of time and out of place. And also, I like the term socially engaged better. I'm not trying to make a point. I'm trying to raise awareness or ask questions.
Are you expressing, and in the best philosophical sense of the term, attitude? Are you expressing an attitude here, a stance that you are taking toward your place in the world?
Well, I think I have a stance. I'm not sure the poems do.
And what is your stance?
Well, obviously, I am very strongly in favor of immigration and very strongly in favor of people who need refuge being able to seek refuge. And I completely understand the reasons why people are trying to come to this country.
Sure.
And I'm sympathetic, clearly. But I don't know that the poem makes that statement so much as it poses the question of where are these people going to go.
You've got a lot of biblical imagery in this poem.
Yeah.
What is the biblical imagery that is here?
So obviously it's referencing the Garden of Eden, but it's in the leaving of that garden. But it's also referencing the story of Lot's wife, turning to salt.
Right.
So there's that story of refuge and escape, and the Bible is all about wandering. I mean, that's, what is it, 40 years in the desert and the exile, and there's so many stories of people needing refuge and people needing hospitality. And there's stories of people being required to give hospitality, and when they don't give it, it's, there's a curse on them, so to speak. And so I was raised very much in a religious household, so I the Bible is very much part of who I am. It's part of my culture. I don't practice any particular faith now, but it's still part of my cultural understanding. And I think there's a real power in some of those stories and some of those images because they are so much part of Western thought, and they're very much part of American thought and American culture. And so I think there's a kind of resonance when you pull on a myth or you pull on a story that a lot of people have access to, it resonates outward in many ways.
What I saw here is that, in a sense, we are the exiles.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think there was a place you came out of to be an exile, you look back and it's not there.
Yes.
In a sense, the metaphysical part of it for me is the sense that we are here.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think there is another here for us, there is not another here. You cannot go back.
Right.
To a place that does not exist.
Yeah.
What you have is here.
Yeah.
And where could we go? We.
Yes.
Who had come from nowhere and hence could not return.
Yeah.
The sense for me and the stance for me, the underpinning of this poem for me anyway, is that we are the exiles.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, from a psychological point of view, we see ourselves as exiles.
Right.
But why is that?
Yeah, well, that's where the Bible starts, with the story of exile, which is what I find interesting. Yeah, and it's right. We always think there's some magical past or something we want to return to. Yeah, and I think that human longing, that very human sense of who we are, is there too. And the we is intentional.
Well, let's continue this theme a little bit, if we can, and read the poem, your poem, Immigrant.
Yes. Immigrant. Forget Hollywood, private homes the size of theaters, swimming pools scooped into every backyard, inalienable rights. If you visit those houses, it will be to mop vast expanses of marble floors or blow leaves from the pool deck. Forget blonde girls who live there, shining like small suns against a blue sky, surfer boys with more muscles than all the village combined. Forget the village. Its dust will never choke you again, kicking down the dull roads leading home to your parents. Forget your parents. This is easy. You send them $200 a month, enough for a year, instead of answers to their questions about the grandkids. Forget the grandkids, your children, who refuse to speak to you in their native tongue and laugh at the way you say sheet, which sounds like shit. They have no idea who you were. Forget who you were. Doctor, actress, teacher, saint, someone with a name no one here can pronounce, that old life itching like a phantom limb or lost city. Even when you save up enough cash and vacation days to make the trip back, it isn't where you left it.
Is there something similar between these two poems?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think so.
No, I'm being facetious here. It's really very clear. So what's going on in this poem, The Immigrant?
Well, this poem is based a little more specifically on the experiences of many of my Bulgarian friends, including my husband, and the sheet that sounds like shit is something we laugh about all the time. There's a couple of things that Bulgarians say that sound, I won't mention some of them because some of them are really inappropriate, but that sound like differently than the word they're trying to pronounce. The issue of children sort of turning their backs on their native culture and the issue of losing your identity to some extent when you become an immigrant. You lose your culture, you lose your profession, you give up a lot to come here. And my husband did it for political reasons, for safety. He was in trouble, so he didn't really have much of a choice. Other people do it for economic reasons, but it's a tremendous sacrifice for whatever reason people choose to make a move to a totally different country, a different culture. I remember when I first visited Bulgaria, everyone thought I had a swimming pool in my backyard. I don't know why. I think it has to do with movies and, you know, images they saw of America. So I thought that was really funny. So I had to get that in there, right? But there's all kinds of ideas that immigrants have about what's going to happen, and almost never does it actually happen the way they imagine it. And America is not always the promised land that they want it to be. And the American dream does happen to some extent for some people. And people are able financially often to succeed here, or at least to succeed more than they would have elsewhere. But they give up family, they give up friends, they give up community, and they give up a lot to do it.
I think that there's a sense that struck me in this poem that when you leave something, because you're gone, you think it's going to stay the same the way you left it.
Right.
And it will be that way.
Right.
When you go back. And in fact, the world moves.
Yeah.
And whether you're there or not,
right,
it moves. And so when you look back or make a trip back, it isn't where you left it.
Yeah. And that's also the experience of the immigration experience changes you, so that when you go back, you're not the same person either. So it has a lot to do with the Song of the Exiles. You become a person who doesn't belong anywhere. Yeah.
Well, Holly Kara Petkova, thank you for a wonderful discussion and for your poetry that I believe reaches into our depths and moves us to think about who we are and what our responsibility is to each other and to our world. And I want to thank the Writers' Center as well for extending their hospitality to us for our discussion, and to Wilson Wyatt for making the arrangements for us. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.